This is Karen Brewster, and today is March 14th, 2022, and I am here in Fairbanks, Alaska, with Colleen Redman, and this is for the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act Project Jukebox. Colleen, thank you for letting me come visit you today. And a lot of what we're going to talk about is related to the Tundra Times and its role in the land claims movement, because your brother was Tom Snap, who helped run the paper with Howard Rock. But before we get there, if you can just tell me a little bit about yourself, where you were born and when you came to Alaska.
Yes, thank you, Karen. I was born in Glade Spring, Virginia, a small community about 30 miles from Bristol, Tennessee, Virginia. And I grew up there. When I graduated, I wanted to go to college, but back then there was no community colleges and it was not that easy to find a college. So I ended up going to a secretarial school in Abingdon, Virginia, and after a year there, I received a job at Kingsport, Tennessee, at Holston. It was during the Korean War, and Holston Ordnance Company, and later it changed its name to Holston Defense, which was a subsidiary of Tennessee Eastman, and they were making composition B and TNT for the military in Korea. Mm. And after 2 years, I could see it was that the Korean War was winding down, and I could see that things were winding down there. And I made an application to Berea College in Berea, Kentucky. I had found out that it had no tuition, and that sounded good.
Yeah.
And so I went to Berea College for 4 years, and when I finished at Berea, I had a scholarship to Boston University for social work. And I completed 1 year of social work, at Christmas I was married to a person that I met in Alaska when I was working at Mount McKinley Park. I worked at Mount McKinley Park the summers of 1956 and 1957. The first time that it was turned over to, that the park was turned over to a private company.
Oh, a concession?
Yeah, National Park Concessions. They had concessions in Blue Ridge Parkway, Everglades in Florida. They were the primary concession company for national parks nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met my husband there, and then I ended up getting married and coming to live in Fairbanks in 1958, and I've lived here continuously.
And how did you end up working in Mount McKinley in those summers? Because you were coming from Virginia.
Yes. Well, in Berea, everybody works. And I worked at the front desk of the Berea College Hotel. And so we went on a field trip to Louisville, Kentucky. And after our hotel management teacher, who was also the head of the Berea College Hotel, after he had shown us around in Louisville and we saw different hotels and different carpet places and so forth, we ended up having a banquet on the roof garden of the Brown Hotel. And at that Brown Hotel was a man by the name of Sandberg from Mammoth Cave. and he was in charge of national park concessions. And so my girlfriend and I, we were always very looking for a summer job. So we asked him about a summer job. He said, "Oh yeah," said, "I could use you on Lake Superior." And then as an afterthought, he said, "We might get a place in Alaska, Mount McKinley." And we said, "Oh, if you do, be sure to let us know." So he calls down to Berea in February of 1956. And he says that they got it. And so we went to Alaska, after our last exam.
Uh-huh.
Never had flown in an airplane. It was a real big step for me.
Yeah, but you went with this friend.
With a friend.
Yeah. And you worked in the hotel then at Mount McKinley?
We did. I worked at Mount McKinley. I worked at the front desk of Mount McKinley Hotel. And she worked as a waitress. And so then I came back the second summer and I met my husband there. And that's what really has anchored me here in Fairbanks,
and was,
Alaska.
And was he from Alaska himself?
No, he was from Texas. Okay. He was from near Sherman, Texas.
But you decided you wanted to live in Alaska?
Oh, yeah. He wanted to. He liked working up here. He liked it here. So we lived here ever since. Then, you know, I've had different jobs. I had started out, I worked for the Territory of Alaska in social work. Mm-hmm. And then I worked I did adoptions. I was the first social worker in a private agency here. I worked at Hospitality House for a mm-hmm. while. And then they asked me to coordinate the boarding home program where they came from the villages to go to high school. And it was 1967 to 1973. And we had lots of Barrow students. Mm-hmm. Well, we had 39 students coming the year of the flood.
Oh.
And then which was 1967, and we had to find homes on higher land. And then by 1973, there was like 275 students.
Wow.
But we had them not all in Fairbanks. We had them in places like Tananaw, Galena, Tok, Delta. So we had them in other areas too.
Mm-hmm.
And it was real interesting, you know, that I remember these two really good players from Barrow. And in the class 2A, well, they would want them, Nenana would want them, and Tok would want them, and whoever I sent those two boys to would win the championship.
For basketball?
For basketball. Because they, and then after the basketball season was over, they would come back through, going back to Barrow. Anyway, it was an interesting program.
And was that a state program?
It was state it was under state operated schools.
Okay.
Out of Juneau.
Okay.
And it was a really good deal because the state, they only paid $5 a day, and they paid the ticket in and the ticket out, but they did not pay for anybody that, you know, if a parent died or anything.
Right.
We had to figure out how to manage that.
And did the host families that they stayed with provide all the food and everything? Or
they did. And they provided a lot more.
Yeah.
You know, you get a family like, take Jay Ramis's family. We had several students from Allakaket with them. And they have to babysit Jay and his brother. But on the other hand, you would see the parents having them out for dinner. They'd take him on trips. It was a really good deal. It was a really good exchange because mm-hmm. a lot of students, I've been here long enough to see them have children and grandchildren and get university degrees, many of them after many years, and become teachers. It was a really, I think, good. And the reason it came about was at the time that at the time that the people across the United States were busing kids across town for integration, mm-hmm. Alaska was flying them out to Indian schools in Chilaca, Oklahoma, and Chihuahua, Oregon.
Right.
We only had, for high school students, we only had Mount Edgecombe, and it couldn't hold all of them. Well, when the Native Associations, when the land claims and the pipeline was coming, they got very active, and they started demanding that these kids be brought home. Mm-hmm. And so, but they didn't have schools in the villages. So they come up with the idea of having them in homes until they built the schools.
Okay.
And so then they built the schools, and at the rest of the country was consolidating schools, Alaska went back to the little red schoolhouse. But it was an interesting time, and university people, I mean, we had, you know, all walks of life taken. We tried to get the best parents we could for them.
Mm-hmm.
But
very interesting.
And I did that, and then I joined my brother in doing the newspaper.
Okay.
And we did the All Alaska Weekly newspaper, mm-hmm. from 1970 to 1987.
Okay.
And in 1985, I took a job as a counselor at Ben Allison High School. And I did that from 1985 until 1997.
So you were working?
I've been retired ever since.
1997.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were the school counselor and also helping with the newspaper
at
the same time?
Well, at the same time. But I wasn't doing it full time, so I helped him. But I did go back to, because Tom's health was declining, and we were trying to. He was in negotiations with Brian Rogers to sell the paper, and so I went to work at Ben Allison.
Okay, and so for people who don't know about the All Alaska Weekly, let's start with that one before we move to the next papers.
Okay.
About what that paper was and the kinds of stories they covered.
Well, Tom, from early on, he wanted to be a journalist. He wanted to write. He wrote poetry. He wrote, was always entering contests, everything. So he, but when he graduated from high school as valedictorian, my dad insisted he go to business school in Roanoke, Virginia. But after 6 months, the money ran out, and he came back and he went to this business school that I mentioned that I went to. He went to it before me.
Okay.
And so then he was in the military. And in the military, he took lots of courses. And then he ended up following me to Berea and pulling together the courses that he did in the military and getting a degree from Berea. So both, I had three brothers, no sisters, and two of the brothers followed me to Berea after I was there. And then also followed me, he then came up here to visit me.
Tom did.
Oh, so he stayed.
Oh, he came after you.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
He came in 1960. He had been in the military, and he had 1 year of graduate work at University of Missouri, and so he came to visit me for 2 weeks, and he ended up staying. And he went. So before he came, I went down to Mr. Sneddon. And I started telling him how wonderful Tom was, because, so he said, you know, he might be too good for us. So Tom got a job with the News Miner, mm-hmm. in 1960. And then And then, of course, it was 1962 when they started with the meeting in Tanana and the Tundra Times and so forth.
Yeah, the first Dena-Hena-Nanesh, or however our Landar speaks, conference was that first one in Tanana. Oh, actually, no, there was the Nulit Choya one before that. Anyway.
Well, so...
So why did Tom start these other newspapers if there was already the Fairbanks Daily News Miner?
Well, he started, he was working for the News Miner, and he was going to Tanana, this meeting, and the News Miner, it was all this controversy about how the News Miner was not printing the complete articles, and they weren't sending it out on the wire, because they were... It was a big controversy over reservations. The News Miner and they opposed the and the politicians the reservation idea, and it was debated among the native people, just reaching out to see what kind of way they could protect their land.
Mm-hmm.
So
did Tom go to that meeting in Tanana as a reporter for the News Miner?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay. And then they wouldn't print his stories?
Well, they did, but it's all in the line in this 43-page paper,
right,
that he wrote trying to establish the Tundra Times. He puts in there the whole controversy of how they, would change it, would limit him to 250 words, and the restrictions, because they were on the other side of the issue, and he was trying to get the native point of view out.
Okay. So the News Miner was for reservations?
No,
opposed
they were
to
opposed
them.
To registrations. Okay. Very definitely.
Well, a lot of the native community was as well.
Well,
that was later.
They would leave. He tells how they would. He would said something about reservations, and the last part of it was, if someone wanted them, the News Miner would leave out that part about if somebody wanted them. They were changing his stories around. And you have to read that letter,
yeah,
in order to understand that whole controversy.
Yeah, well, I am aware that there was a big controversy about reservations and how they ended up finally with the corporation model later for land claims.
Well, they were just trying to see how to protect their land,
yeah,
because they were seeing it was slipping away from them,
right,
and so they were just looking for and they didn't have money, and so that's when they reached out to Laverne Madigan, and she, the American Association of Indian Affairs, helped them,
right. And then this interview that your daughter did with Tom in 1995,
mm-hmm,
just before he passed away, he talks about that, reaching out to Laverne and asking about big donors that the Association for American Indian Affairs might have, and that's how they ended up with Dr. Henry Forbes.
Yeah. Well, Tom, what he did was, he...
do you want to read what you've written?
Yes, I could.
Because you've written this... that was the other thing he talked about in the interview with your daughter, was the duck in Barrow.
Oh, yeah, the eider duck.
Yeah, but yeah, you've written out something, so go ahead.
Tom thinks, the eider duck was a big thing. It was kind of the tipping point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the atomic energy was there,
mm-hmm,
and it was a big thing too. But the immediate thing seems to me like, from what I've seen in Tom's papers, is them arresting those two Eskimos with a dust duck apiece.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll read then some.
Sure,
here.
Yeah.
My brother Tom Snapp came to visit me for 2 weeks in June of 1960. He ended up staying for 35 years until he passed September 8th, 1995. He got a job first going house to house for the city directory. Then in the fall of 1960, he received a job as a reporter for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. In November 1962, U.S. Solicitor General Ted Stevens said to News Miner publisher Mr. Snedden, "I think you should send a reporter to this meeting at Barrow." Tom was sent as a reporter to attend a meeting of Eskimos concerned with solving some important problems. The meeting had been called to consider the possible explosion of an atomic bomb off the coast of Point Hope, the arrest of two Barra Eskimos, each holding an adder duck supposedly killed out of season, the clubbing of seals by U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and the barring of anyone from visiting the Pribilof Islands, the settlement of the Alaska Native land claims. Tom said he was the only white person at the meeting. This meeting was fully described by Frances Degnan of Unalakleet in her book Under the Arctic Sun. In this book, she wrote about her father, Frank Degnan, who was an active participant. Tom said the discussion was in the Eskimo language, which he did not understand. Even so, ever so often he heard his name mentioned. When he inquired about what was being said, he was told they wanted to have their own newspaper and they wanted an Eskimo, Howard Rock of Point Hope, to be the editor. Furthermore, they wanted Howard to follow Tom around for a year to learn the ropes, so to speak, to learn the newspaper business, how to be a writer and an editor. At the time, Tom had made plans to go to the University of Missouri to complete his master's degree in journalism. Tom inquired, "You mean a newsletter?" He was aware they did not have money to fund the newspaper. They replied, "No, a newspaper. I was living in a mobile home and left Fairbanks in July 1962 for the second year of my master's degree in social work." Tom was living in the mobile home parked in Courtney Court. My mobile home became the office where Tom and Howard were searching for a way to fund an Eskimo newspaper. In December 1962, Tom sat at his typewriter for two days straight, seeking funds to start a newspaper. Tom did not follow the usual avenue of grant writing. He went about it in his own way. Instead of writing a grant proposal, he chose first to find out who would have the money to fund the project. He eventually focused on the American Association of Indian Affairs Board of Directors. One of the richest men on the board was Dr. Henry Forbes of Massachusetts. Tom's investigation revealed that Dr. Forbes had, at one time, visited Howard's village of Point Hope, and that he had a niece in Fairbanks, Joan Kopanen. So Tom sat at his typewriter for 2 days straight, writing a 43-page letter detailing the native situation and why a newspaper was needed. He sent the letter to Dr. Forbes. Months went by and he did not get an answer. Finally, he heard from Dr. Forbes. On September 7, 1963, Dr. Forbes contacted Tom and Howard, agreeing to assist the paper monetarily if they could get an issue out by the 1st of October, as there was going to be an important announcement coming at that time. Tom and Howard got busy. Tom said that most of the first issue was political ads, as an election was coming up, and this was a good way to raise money. The announcement was news about the Alaska land claims legislation. Dr. Forbes continued to fund a considerable portion of the expenses of the Thunder Times, as the newspaper was named. At first it was an Eskimo paper, and later they added Indian and Aleut to the description. The money they received each year came from rental property Dr. Forbes owned on Long Island, New York. Some years the amount was $35,000. Additional funds were raised with the annual Thunder Times banquet. The funding ceased in the early 90s when Dr. Forbes died and contributed to the ending of the Thunder Times. Tommy and Marilyn Richards were the last editors and were involved in the transition of photographs and other materials to the Tussey Library in Barrow. The Tussey Library devoted about 20% of their staff's time to archiving of Thunder Times materials. The library paid to have it digitized and it can be accessed on the World Wide Web. Tom taught Howard the newspaper business, writing and editing. Tom decided he would use his own method to teach Howard journalism. He encouraged him to write about the things he knew and cared about, for example, his Eskimo adoption. Another example, a journalist, when writing an editorial, usually overstates to get the point across. Howard did the opposite. If you read his understated editorials, you would say, "Oh yeah, that's true." Howard was an artist and could lay out the paper perfectly using his artistic ability. Tom agreed to postpone his graduate school for 1 year and a day to help Howard learn to produce the Thunder Times. Some of the paper's early stories were published over and over in later issues. One of Howard's editorials urged the board to keep the paper going, not to let it cease publication after it was gone. Sadly, a vote of the board, including one decisive abstention, resulted in the Thunder Times' demise in the early 90s after Dr. Forbes passed and the funding from him stopped. The Thunder Times reported on the explosion planned by the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. Two UAF professors led the opposition. Their names, Les Varick and Bill Pruitt. Dan O'Neill later wrote about this in the Firecracker Boys book. The Thunder Times reported on the explosion planned by the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. As I said, those two UAF professors in later years were honored by the university. Another project that Thunder Times opposed was the clubbing of the seals by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on the Pribilof Islands. The people of the Pribilofs had one employer, U.S. Fish and Wildlife. The people had nice housing, a company store where they had a charge account. However, they were afraid to say anything against the Fish and Wildlife Agency for fear of losing their jobs with the island's only employer. In writing about this situation in the Thunder Times, Tom quoted Tennessee Ernie Ford saying they owed their soul to the company store. The Fish and Wildlife Agency, controlling the people's life, would dish out a portion of sugar, coffee, and candy. No one could come on the island, not even Aleut Carl Moses, who tried to visit the island campaigning for his political office. The profit from the seals went to Fish and Wildlife. It was exceedingly difficult for Tom and Howard to get the story as the people were afraid to talk. Occasionally, they would find an islander who had come to the mainland for dental care that would talk if it were anonymous. The Thunder Times played an important role in opening up the Pribilof Islands and eliminating the program for the Fish and Wildlife. After this happened, Senator Bob Bartlett, Alaska human rights head Willard Bowman, and Tom Snapp visited the Pribilof Islands. When I went to Ween Airlines to buy Tom's ticket, the agent said, "Oh, we can't sell a ticket to the Pribilofs." I replied, "Now you can." And after she did some checking with supervisors, she sold me Tom's ticket. The four major concerns of the Barrow Eskimos, the possible explosion of an atomic bomb off the coast of Point Hope, the clubbing of seals by U.S. Fish and Wildlife and the barring of anyone from visiting the Pribilof Islands, the arrest of two Barrow Eskimos, each holding an eider duck supposedly killed out of season, the settlement of the Alaska native land claims, all four concerns were resolved favorably to Alaska natives, including the Barrow Eskimos. A few years ago, Tom and Howard were honored posthumously by the Alaska Press Club. They named their prestigious First Amendment Award the Tom Snapp Howard Rock Award and made the presentation at the annual meeting of the Alaska Press Club in Anchorage.
Okay, great. That's a good summary of it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that could be a good starting point in case you have any questions.
Yes, I do. So, that was the Tundra Times, which she started in, you said 1963, right?
Well, no, yeah, 62 was when they went to the meeting in November.
The meeting in Barrow?
I think that was the meeting in Barrow. And so he didn't hear, he wrote the letter, and he didn't hear until September of 63,
okay.
September 7th, 63.
Okay.
And that's when he said that they had to very quickly, if they could very quickly get this paper out, that he would assist them.
Mm-hmm.
And the first check was $35,000. I'm not sure how much he gave them each month. I don't know that. Probably that's in the records that have up there.
Yeah. But Forbes said, well, there was some important issue that was coming up
in
October.
It was to do with the land claims that was coming up.
Okay.
That was the big issue.
Okay. And now we had mentioned the... Well, wait. With Tundra Times... You helped with the business end of it? Or that was with the Alaska Weekly?
No, at that time I was doing other things. I was with doing social work and so forth. But I did, I was gone that year that they were starting.
Right.
I was in Boston.
Getting your master's.
Getting my master's with my children. Well, no, and I wasn't in Boston. I was in Richmond, Virginia.
Oh.
See, I got the first year, 57 to 58,
mm-hmm.
right after I graduated from college. Then I got married, and I came back up to Alaska, and I was going to lose, if I didn't go that year, you know, within 6 years, I was going to lose that first year. So I went back, and I got it in Richmond, Virginia, because then I was closer to my mother, and,
mm-hmm.
and we could go on weekends for... And I did my thesis on consideration of Indian and Eskimo adoptions to white parents.
Wow, you're ahead of your time.
I know, and I couldn't, but the thing was, I couldn't get the records from the office because they were confidential. So it was kind of an exploratory one, and I got different samples of Native Americans living with families in Richmond. But anyway, yeah.
And so then you came back up here in 64?
No, I went there from July of 62 until like June of 63.
Oh, okay, it was just 1 year.
Three.
Yeah.
And so they were still trying to get the newspaper going.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have money. They were still looking for money, and he was still trying to help them.
Mm-hmm.
But he had agreed to help Howard, so he's helping Howard with the journalism thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to get it. They're trying to get money any way they can.
Mm-hmm. And then once the paper was up and going and people were subscribing to it, or Forbes just kept footing the bill?
Oh, and that was just a small part of it. I mean, they had a banquet. Once a year, and they got money from the banquet, and then they had subscribers all over the state.
Mm-hmm.
It was statewide.
Right. Yeah.
At first, it was Eskimo, and then they added Elliot and Indian to it.
And then they also probably had I know they had advertisers that helped.
And at the same time, this was going on. This was when in Tanana they're getting this meeting going.
Mm-hmm.
And this Laverne Madigan from the American Association of Indian Affairs is helping, with that.
Right.
And because they're helping them to bring people in from the villages.
Mm-hmm.
And Alfred Ketzler and was the young, handsome chair of the meeting.
And now did Tom went down to Tanana for that meeting? Was he still a reporter with
the
newsminer?
He was still a reporter with the newsminer. But he, and the thing he says, he because of the issue, he told him he was going to quit because they weren't reporting it right. He
mm-hmm.
he was really mad about how they were reporting it,
mm-hmm.
that they weren't given the full story.
Right. And then there's also the Jessens Weekly.
Yes. Now the Jessens Weekly, when Tom came in 1960, he worked just a short time for the News Miner, just before that, and then he helped. It was a year or two at most,
mm-hmm.
and then after he came back from this year of in Columbia, Missouri, for his second year in journalism, graduate school, he got a job with Jesson's Weekly. And at one time, he'd edited Jesson's Weekly, and after the flood, it went daily and Sunday. And he edited the daily, the weekly, and the Sunday for Jesson's Weekly, up wow. until it folded in, because in late 69. And then he started the Alaska Weekly up with the subhead from that. The way Jesson's Weekly, the subhead was the Pioneer Alaska Weekly. So that what happened was after the flood, they got loans and they had a big staff. They had like 10 reporters. Charlie Willis was involved with it, but it went under. And so the IRS locked it up.
Mm-hmm.
So Mr. Jesson couldn't be a part of it. And they put Mrs. Jesson's name on it, but she wanted really no part of it. So
right.
Tom ended up buying it and starting it as with the subhead for Jesson's
mm-hmm.
Weekly in 1970.
Okay. And there was enough news to report to have the News Miner and these other papers?
Well, Tom was one, I mean, to this day, people meet me on the street and say, we wish Tom was here, you know. He could put it in a way. He wrote for like fourth grade. I mean, people knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept the opinion in the opinion page, and he kept the news in the other. And he didn't care. We didn't have that many ads. So it didn't matter that much. No advertisers was keeping him from saying what he wanted to say.
So how did he fund those if there were no advertisers? Subscriptions?
Well, it was very hard. One thing that helped us was that he would talk to people like at the borough and so forth, that they gave him that big ad for the property, you know. So every year we'd get an infusion of money about March whenever they put that big ad in the paper, you know, and things like that. But we didn't take people off of the rolls very easily, you know. So some of them, but no subscriptions. And then I developed a thing where I knew people from the villages, and these people right now, P.J. Simon, he
mm-hmm.
said I was your paper boy. Nick Emmel, you know, they'll tell me they were their paper boys.
So it went to the villages.
Yeah. So I sent it out to a lot of villages. And we sent it out all over the state. We
mm-hmm.
had people in Anchorage and in Kodiak and all that carried Alaska Weekly. And during the pipeline, then the pipeline people would take a lot of copies.
All right.
So that helped a lot. And then I had another business where I had money that I could back it up. If you didn't have money for the, because we had to pay the News Miner, it cost a lot to.
Oh, because you used their printing press?
Uh-huh.
Oh.
And it was real interesting. We were big friends with Bob Perry and Don Sunderland, the pressmen. And so we took our paper over. Tom never missed. He'd taken the paper over there at 9 o'clock on Thursday morning, and then it came off in the afternoon. No matter how sick he was or anything, he was always there. And then because I had money back up, you know, we always were able to pay for it. So that's the way we were able to get through it. But he worked long hours and had very little help. And some of the help would, you know, that he'd do this freelance, you know, pay them, or that, you know, one would bring in cartoons and
mm-hmm.
he'd pay them and all this. And we had, and the people we did have, Lee Alder, you know, such a dedicated staff that could do anything. He would teach. At his funeral, one of the things that they said was that it was like a school, because he would teach all journalism, because you had to operate you had to be able to do everything in that office. In case you weren't busy with one thing, you know, he would have you do another. So he had people working subscriptions, and they could also lay it out, or they could, you know, do. But it was like he was teaching journalism.
Yeah. Well, that's probably the best way to learn it.
And he had such a good memory. He could he could call it, you know, for about 20 or 30 years, he was the president of the press club. And he could call them all with just memory. He just memorized, he knew their phone numbers without even looking at anything.
Wow.
Before he had his stroke and right. so forth. But he was journalism all the way. And he didn't have, you know, like they said on that thing, he didn't have a lot of money. He never did make a lot of money. He only, from the time he started it to the time he sold it, he paid himself $200 a week. And that was it. That's like $10,000 a year or whatever. Well, when people bought it, they thought they could, you know, pay themselves. The money was not there, you know, for it, really.
And that was
so it's a public service. His whole yeah. deal was a public service.
And that was the Tundra Times, or that was the All Alaska
Weekly?
Oh, that
was All Alaska Weekly. Okay. No, he wasn't with the Tundra Times all that much. You know, he helped Howard get started, and he helped to start it.
Mm-hmm.
But he was, his, you know, he went off to school. He helped, he postponed his second year to help Howard for a year and a day. Then he went back to school, and then the paper, you know, he got some money from Dr. Forbes, and then Howard was the editor.
Mm-hmm.
Howard was. I think he did write stories for in it, but I'm not sure. But mostly it was just getting it started.
Okay.
And it was started in this mobile home that I had. It was parked over across from what's now the diner, but and Courtney Court.
Okay.
It was called Nita's Cafe.
Okay.
And so he and Howard, they would write in there. They took care of these two parakeets of mine, and they would write stories about those parakeets in the early days. And then when I came back, and one of them had died, and I was bringing it in the house, and it flew up in the tree over there. I said, "Oh no, this famous parakeet is up in the tree now." but they started it there, and they would laugh about, you know, getting peanut butter and jelly on the copy and all this. But that's where he wrote the letter, and they had no money, and
it was a brilliant idea to start the Tundra Times and have a paper focused on native issues, and land claims was really heating up.
Oh yeah, that's what they were just worrying. And he tells about it in there how they were BNA was dropping in and surveying the land, and they could just see their land being pulled out from under them.
Yeah.
And so it was like Tana Cross and Northway and Minto and Nenana. Those were the main ones of that meeting at Tananaw, I think.
Right, right.
And but that meeting was very interesting because all this was happening at the same time, at 62.
Right.
So this Laverne Manigan, who she ended up falling at Kotzebue or something and breaking her arm, and I mean it's. Anyway, and then she ended up dying, you know,
yeah.
so she didn't, but she was so instrumental early on, you know, with it. And she helped Alfred and them get money to bring those people in from the villages.
Right.
Because when they're not together, they don't have a newspaper. How are they going to do an impact?
Right.
So then all these politicians wanted to go down there and ended up going down there. But Alfred was trying to keep everybody out that wasn't a member.
Right.
So he writes about Father Convair wanting to get in the meeting, you know, because he was a priest, and then about Ralph Perdue saying that some group elected him at Birch Park, which they found out was not true. He named Bud Hagberg and so forth was at the meeting, and Bud Hagberg said there was no meeting. So it sounded like that Ralph Perdue, he was raised by a white family up here, and he had different views on the native, and it seems like that he tried to stop it, along with the news miner, some of the things that they were doing. Because they would say that, like Laverne Winding, that she was an outsider, that she was putting in, but she was really helping them. I mean, she was getting money. It's in one of the letters that she first said that she could send $600 to $800, which was a lot back then, to help bring delegates in, you know, to the meeting in Tanana.
I was wondering if Howard and Tom would have met her first in Barrow at that meeting, or I know she went to Point Hope with Howard.
Well, not at that meeting, because, you know, he said he was the only white person there. And he heard him mentioning him his name, and he finally found out that what it was all about.
Yeah, I know she was in. I know she went to the meeting in Tanana.
Well, she helped them in Tanana to get the people in there.
Right.
I know that.
I know she was there because there's a photograph.
Oh,
in Bear Ketzler's collection.
Oh, yeah.
Of her there. Her and Ted Hetzel.
Yeah.
And there's another photo of Tom and Howard and Ted.
Well, both things, both that meeting in Tanana with the chiefs and the Barrow meeting, it's a time when they're trying to figure out what in the world, how can we not have our land just pulled right up from under us, and how can we help ourselves?
Yeah. Well, and you'd say the Tundra Times played a critical role in the communication statewide, bringing people together, and they needed that unity to get it all through.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, did you do anything with the Tundra Times, or you helped with the All Alaska Weekly?
Mostly the All Alaska Weekly, because the Tundra Times, it was starting when I was out in Richmond. For that second year.
Right, but well, yeah, when you came back.
Uh-huh. But when I came back, then I went back to, I think I went back to, let's see, 67. Well, when I came back, let's see, 62, 63. Oh, I went back and worked some for the state of Alaska in the welfare office. And then it was with the boarding home from 67. Mm-hmm. And I had my children in the meantime, and I did, you know, like 3 days a week with when I came back and did adoptions at the Alaska Weekly. I mean, at the
state.
At the state, yeah.
Yeah.
But so I had kind of a life, I mean, you know, in addition to Tom's. But we were close. He was the best brother in the world to me. I don't think we hardly ever disagree. I just always looked up to him and just... You know, so we were just thought a lot alike and everything. We got along real good, which was good. You know, it was too bad that his health didn't hold out, because he at the time was writing a book about Ed Parsons
who's Ed Parsons?
Well, Ed Parsons is the ones that brought the cable. He's the father of cable TV, and he was one to put the. He put the communication system in for Ween and also on the Dew Line.
Oh, okay.
And anyway, he's called the father of cable TV.
Oh.
But anyway, it's a long story. But he was writing a lot of stuff. He was, you know, so interested in doing it. And then he was only 66 when he passed.
Yeah. And so did you help with the office business side of the All Alaska Weekly?
Yeah, I was like chief cook and bottle washer. And I wish now that I'd done more of the writing, because he wanted me to write. But I took pictures, I went on the trips, mostly I saw to the business part of it, and helped with just all the other stuff besides. He mostly just stuck to the journalism.
Right. Somebody had to keep
the books. I did advertising and oversaw the circulation advertising, went around and I did the pictures, printed them down in my bathroom downstairs. And I had kids in here folding the newspapers, and I paid them so much. And then when they'd run out, I had a basketball goal out there, and my son did, so they'd go out there to shoot baskets. I started paying them by the piece. But they all, like Susan Pascavan, all her family, worked with us at the All Alaska Weekly. and Marie Yaska from Huslia, mm-hmm. Curtis. Tom had a folding, and he had, you know, he every day he had a routine where he marked the papers, and he would, until you read the papers, you didn't know what the news was. So he did that every morning, and his stories, like education and all, and he would put a circle around it. He'd put AD in for Alaska, Daily News, and put the date on it, and education or whatever the subject was. And he had a whole wall of envelopes with these clippings. And when we sold the paper, one of the things was is that if they didn't keep it, that he got some of those things back. But they apparently they threw them all away. Yeah. But he had put so much time, because he said you had to know what had happened in order to know what to write about. And he had about 40 of these cheap recorders, mm-hmm. because he was so much on having it accurate that he carried that tape recorder everywhere. And in this day of fake news, all mm-hmm. I can think of is how much he spent trying to make it accurate. He could write shorthand like 150 words a wow. minute, and he could and so he would have that tape recorder. And then he would transcribe it before he ever started to write an article. So he was very much on being accurate.
Yeah.
And he was also involved nationally. We did go to, the National Journalism Society of Professional Journalism meetings. And he would, he was on the National FOI, Freedom of Information Committees. And I've got pictures, you know, of all of that, of us going to these. I've got a thing downstairs, a big, that's signed by Sandra Day O'Connor, that Sam Donaldson auctioned off in Washington, D.C., at one of our journalism SPJ meetings, and Tom bid on it. Mm-hmm. And so it's signed, it's a Declaration of Independence signed mm-hmm. by Sandra Day O'Connor, a real big
nice.
Thing. But he was very much in the, you know, for the freedom of the press and
so those clippings, like he would clip something that was in the Anchorage newspaper, and then he would pursue it locally.
Oh, he was just getting the information about what had been written, because his deal was you don't know what to write until you see what has been said about it.
Okay. But yeah, he didn't just pull it off the wire like they do now and copy it. He wrote his own.
Oh yeah, I mean he was journalism from the word go. It was just amazing how he was so dedicated. I mean, he worked late in the morning and.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like he did most of. What it took to run that paper.
He did. He said everybody was a story. I remember one time this man came in and his shirt was open, and you know, Tom was real tired. I knew it was on his deadline, and so I said, well, could you come back tomorrow? I never did that again, because Tom was waiting for that man. It was from the Culinary Union, I think. He was waiting for that man to come for his headline story, you know. So you never knew. He said everybody was a story. One time we had one come in there, and he was telling for an ad, and then Tom got a big story out of just while he was in there for the ad. So he could recognize the story.
Yeah.
And he could recognize how the picture he wanted, you know, to tell that story.
So, I mean, I'd say we all think of Tundra Times with the native land claims, but him writing for the All Alaska Weekly, was he writing about land
oh,
claims?
Oh, yeah, he did. And he also, you know, I went to the villages a lot for all the stick dances and all that, and he covered the villages really good.
Okay.
Because we were circulating our papers out there, plus the fact that that we were interested in those issues. He had picture pages on the stick dances and a lot of things from the villages.
So how did you get selected to go where? Like, were you the only photographer, so he sent you?
Oh, well, yeah, I would go. But, oh, yeah, he didn't, you know, he didn't have but one or two employees for most of the time. And it was kind of a one-man operation,
right.
Almost.
So that's what I mean. He couldn't go out to some of those places.
No, but he did. He went a lot more than he, you know, even when he went on the pipeline some too. But I went on the pipeline and all. But yeah, we would just. He wanted it covered, and so we would go out to the villages and.
What a good sister to go do all that, because you weren't an employee, were you?
Oh, well, yeah.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, during that time I wasn't working some other place, and I took $200. We both took the same salary the whole time. And then, but I saw to the, you know, the bookkeeping, the taxes and everything like that.
Yeah. I was going to say, that's my question, is that he was focused on the journalism,
yeah,
and was perhaps not as good at managing the business side.
Yeah, and he just left that to me. And but he did negotiate with Brian Rogers for about 2 years to sell it. And I did for a long time. I didn't know he was negotiating with him about it.
Mm.
But it passed after we sold it. There was, you know, different ones. Andy Williams was the editor part of the time, and not Andy Williams, but Andy Williams, I think, is the song.
Oh, the singer, yeah.
But anyway, it was Andy that used to be at the, it was really an outstanding at the Alaska, at the Anchorage Daily News. But anyway, it was interesting that he saw that his health was not going to allow him to continue.
Right.
And so he negotiated to sell it.
And then Brian Rogers bought it?
It was a group. It had Nilo and Brian and several people involved in it.
Okay. And then how did it end up disappearing altogether?
Well, there was, I don't know, Joe Sitton was in it, and then he left, and then Tom Alton was a while, they finally just folded. They finally just folded it.
Financially, they couldn't keep it?
Yeah, they couldn't keep it. Because, you know, they'd all think they were going to make it, use electronics and the typewriter. I mean, he did it the old-fashioned way. We actually did the Verotype 1 letter at a time for the headlines. And everybody thought, well, they thought they was going to modernize it and everything, and it's going to make all this money with it, but it was not a money-making thing.
Yeah. Journalism still is not necessarily a money-making thing.
I know it. Whenever people, I was a counselor, you know, and someone would come in and say they wanted to go into journalism, it's all I could do to keep a straight face. But at the same time, I didn't want to throw cold water if they were dedicated like he was. Because that's what we need now,
yeah.
Somebody down here dedicated like Tom was.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'd say, what else are you going to do? Because I knew that it's a struggle.
Yeah.
And it's too bad it's that way, because it's so necessary.
Yeah, but we do. Well, so in Tom's time, being that dedicated and hardworking, was that unusual in the newspaper business at the time, or that was the way it was done?
Well, I just think he was unusual. I mean, he was. I've got letters here that he wrote. He wrote a letter almost every day from Korea.
Oh.
And that is a whole other story.
Right.
Because he spent most, he didn't ever have any money, and neither did any of the rest of them. But he spent his money a lot on taking courses, because he was trying to advance his education, you know, while he's in the military. Hmm. When he was drafted, he volunteered the night before he was drafted, and they put him in a Stars and Stripes, or the Air Force Review.
Oh, right.
Or whatever, their paper, and he just loved it. For 8 months he had that job, and they flew him all over. He came by home. He went to Washington, D.C. He interviewed Eddie Rickenbacker. And then someone with a higher rank wanted him in Korea, in Seoul, Korea, in the office of the adjutant general, because he could do that fast shorthand, and he could do steno mask and everything. And so anyway, that's another whole story of the letters, and it gives you an idea of exactly what was going on there and how hard he worked, because every time they would bring someone in the office, he would be so hopeful that they would have skills, mm-hmm. and they would just be, you know, just barely starting, and they would want the stuff the next day, and he'd work till midnight. So you can see how hard he worked even in there. But all of this prepared him for where he ended up, you know, because he's always, I mean, at college he edited the Pinnacle, the college newspaper, uh-huh. and contributed at Berea to the Town newspaper. In our hometown, he had, you know, so he always was in the newspaper business.
Right.
And that was his cup of tea. He could do it real fast. The thing of it is, he didn't like it because a lot of times he didn't want to wait for a week to put his news out.
Right.
So during when Hickel was in and there was a lot happening, he just couldn't stand it. So he just started putting out a little paper called the Snapper, and he'd have me take it around to the places like the co-op, the coffee places. Mm-hmm. He said people just want a little bit of news while they're having their coffee, and so he just had me to take it around there, free, and put it, you know, on the counters and so forth.
Yeah, especially during land claims when there was so much in the pipeline, so much happening.
Yeah.
To only report once a week, it's by the time you got the paper out, it was old news.
You know, and he got so many awards at the press club, and at first we competed against all the papers competed, and eventually the Anchorage papers that they pulled out and put the weekly in a separate category. But he won a lot of awards, for his stories. And some of them were just kind of amazing, things that he wrote.
And so I can assume that the editorial stance of the weekly was pro-native and pro-land claims?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was pro-reporting on what they, he was always for trying to tell it. He had a method of getting the news out that was kind of interesting. You know, if he was calling, say, Chuck Reese or someone on the school board, he would say something, and then he would say, or this, and they'd say, oh no, he would say the opposite, you know, and they would come back real forceful, because it was hard to get people, and he says especially women, to make statements mm-hmm. that you can report. So he would say that, and he'd say oh no, and so he would know the whole story, but he would act what he called Marilyn Monroe dumb, where he would just act like he didn't know, you know, and ask the question and so forth, and he would get, and they would come up with some of the other opposite positions, and then they would make it very definite, you know, what the statement was.
Right, that's smart.
Another thing about in teaching Howard, I think I read that, but I'm just going to state it again, about how Howard could make the understatement and make his point, whereas ordinarily a journalist overstates to make the point. He could understate it, and you would say, oh yeah, that's true. And mm-hmm. and it would, so he made his points in a native fashion, you know.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Of how he did the journalism and his editorials.
Yeah. So maybe you said this already, how Tom and Howard met.
Well, Howard, he was in the Nordale Hotel, and he was an artist, and also that is where Ralph Perdue also had a place in there.
His jewelry place.
Jewelry place. And that's how they met. And that's how, yeah, so, but he met him there, and then the Newsbinder, then that came up at the Newsbinder where they sent him. Mm-hmm. And then Howard, I think it was at the meeting. I think it was at Barrow, really.
Well, that's what I was wondering, if that's where they actually met.
I think so. Yeah. They might have known each other at the Nordell Hotel, but I think it's mainly that Barrow meeting.
Okay.
Which, you know, it was unusual for Snedden to send someone, but it was Stevens, who was the Solicitor General, that told Stevens,
told Snedden
to send someone to the meeting. Because they probably were getting worried about reservations or something.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, why would the Fairbanks paper care about covering something way up in Barrow? And especially at that time, the Native people didn't have the political power and economic power that they do now. Mm-hmm. So to get that attention is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And so after teaching Howard, Howard just took over and did it? And
yeah. But I think that Tom may have contributed. I think there's articles of Tom's in there.
Yeah.
And I think that he also carried it in Alaska Weekly. Later on, we were in the where the parking garage is downtown. Mm-hmm. We were up over, that was the Leprechaun Room down below.
Okay.
And then up above, it was where we were.
Okay.
And then Howard, and they had the Tundra Times over there, and then it was across the street, and then also he was in Tommy's Elbow Room.
Right.
And then the people in the Polaris building, they would look over at us working all night on Wednesday night.
So the paper came out Thursdays?
Thursday. He took it over there at 9 o'clock in the morning. Oh, what I started to say about Bob Perry and Don Sunderland, they would protect it, you know, so that the news people over there couldn't see what Tom's headlines were, because we weren't going to come out till afternoon, and we didn't want them to have the same hit, because he would get stories that they hadn't had. But they would let Kent Sturgis and them in the newsroom, they said it kept them out, they protected it. Well, see, we have a contract for them to print it, mm-hmm. you know, so.
But how did you do all the layout? You said you did it with the...
We had a typesetter. We had a typewriter, you know, where they can justify and everything, you know, those IBM machines they had before they had computers. And so we set the type. And Lee Alder, that she could set type, she could, you know, do the subscriptions, she could help with layout, she could do all of that.
But you set the type at the News Miners Press, so you set it in your office and carried it over?
Oh, we set it all in our office. It was all ready to go. We just took it over there to be printed.
Okay.
No, they didn't set it. We set it.
And then?
And if our equipment didn't work, sometimes we had to go and use it from the university, from their newspaper there.
And what about the Tundra Times? Did Howard do it the same way, or did he have his own printing press?
Oh, no, he had to have it printed, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So he did it at the News Miner?
Uh-huh. I think so. I think it's where it's printed, yeah. Nobody had any ability to print except them.
Right, but then you did all the layout yourself with the...
Oh, yeah, the layout. You had to put it through there and make it stick it on and cut the copy and all that.
Yeah.
But the people were good. I'd call up people, you know, for the ads and all. Go around, and there were certain ones that were real good to us. Mr. Crafton, Tip Top Chevrolet, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Jakovich. One time, as Joe Jakovich, he got older and his kids took over the mm-hmm. business, and he would always give me an ad, like a big page of an ad, and I'd go down there, you know, and sometimes I wouldn't do that much on Monday and Tuesday, but on Wednesday I was really getting the ads for that paper. And after Joe Jakovich retired, his kids, they weren't as much to support, you know, to give me an ad. So one time I needed this ad real bad for the back page, and so I called over there and I said, I'm going to speak to Joe Jakovich. He said, oh, he's in Palm Springs. So what's his number? I called him at Palm Springs. So used to when I would call him, he would say, Colleen Redman, All Alaska Weekly. So I called him down there and he says, Colleen Redman, I'll be damned. He was so surprised that I called him down into Palm Springs. I said, can I put your ad on the back page? He said, sure, go ahead. But they were good to us. Different people were good to us. That helped a lot with what ads we did get. Mm-hmm. And we did get more ads and all, and they took more papers. They would buy a lot of papers during the pipeline. That helped us a lot when the pipeline was here.
Yeah, yeah. They had to have a paper out at all those construction camps.
Tom was not able to hardly go back, and my mother was always wanting him to come until the pipeline, and then he got money ahead, and he got Joanne Wald, and then one time he got Lee Alder's husband, Don Alder, to edit it.
Oh.
So he could take a vacation. He had never had a vacation. But this Joanne Wald, if you know about
her. I know the name, yeah.
Well, she, you know, she had polio, and she did it with her mouth. She did the pencil with her mouth. And I would take the copy down there, and she was down on 2nd Avenue there, and I would take it, and we'd fix it up. And, you know, she had, it was... He said she could do more with her little finger than a lot of people could go. She got a lead story from Hesden Schuylkill because she knew people. She lived here. But she was an interesting person, too.
Yeah.
Joanne Wald.
I know the name. And Hesden Schuylkill, he was with the pipeline and the Department of Transportation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. Yeah. Hesden Schuylkill. But anyway, I'm probably getting off of the subjects.
Well, I don't know. You had other things written down about that you wanted to talk about related to.
I don't think.
Land claims.
You know, you could just ask me questions. It's hard for me to know.
Well, we're going. Yeah, one of the land claim story, the Tundra Times played a large role.
Uh-huh.
I don't really know where I was going, but that I guess being involved in the newspaper business at the time, what do you see as the role of those newspapers?
Well, you wouldn't know what went on in any meeting if you didn't have a newspaper or a reporter there. And that's why it's so important now that we do more with journalism and pay them more and have more. Because that's how people get their information in order to act on it. But a lot of people don't realize, you know, Tom would say, I can put in on the news side that, you know, that this person got, you know, $3,000 bail or whatever for some. And unless I tell them that's excessive bail, they may not even think that that's excessive bail.
Right.
He has to tell them on the opinion page there, the editorial, you know, some of what's going on. So it's Dermot Cole talks about this a lot.
Yeah.
And Dermot, getting back to Dermot and the Newsminer staff, Debbie Corder, Susan Fisher and them, they all worked together. They would come to our office and we put out this Freedom of Information newspaper and so forth. And I've got pictures of like Dermot with black hair and didn't know he was married to Debbie Carter for a long time. And then Susan Fisher spoke at Tom's funeral, and so did Dermot. And
so what was the Freedom of Information Act doing?
Well, you know, it's national where people can go.
Right.
It's the whole thing about freedom of the press.
Right.
You know.
And you guys produced articles about that?
Well, no, Tom would go to these meetings. Oh, yeah, we had a local meeting, the Society of Professional Journalism, you know. They have articles in the magazines and all about, it's the journalism's, you know, it's their journalism
it's their code of ethics.
Their code of ethics and all that, yeah.
Right.
That you have it accurate and all.
Right. And Freedom of Information Act requests are very complicated.
They want things to be open, and a lot of times things are hidden. And so there's for the freedom of the press is that you can go and you can they've got laws passed where you can ask for information and then they right. have to give it to you.
Right. They stall as much as they can.
They stall as much as they can.
Right. I was just thinking about the period of the height of the land claims movement, you know, the late 60s, early 70s, and what the attitudes and atmosphere was like in Alaska or in Fairbanks.
The land claims?
Yeah, what that period was like living through it.
Well, there was just a lot of discussion about how it should be done, and it was amazing that they got as much done as they did, and without, you know, the tundra times and a lot of efforts of the native people, I don't think it would have ever happened. And you know, so that's, I'm glad that they're doing the series that they're doing mm-hmm. about it, because that's...
And were you involved in any of it, or other than through the newspaper?
Not really. I was involved with Native people, but I wasn't involved that much in the claims itself. But because of the boarding home, I mean... there was a lot of little side stories right. you would hear, like how they came about building the schools in the villages, that you know, some of the parents felt they shouldn't have to send their kids so far away from home, and so they had a draw, from what I understand, they had a drawing in Bethel, and they put these names in a hat, and they drew out the name of Molly Hooch, and then they filed that court case in her name. Mm-hmm. She was a 14-year-old girl in Bethel area, I think, and saying that children shouldn't have to go, you know, that far away to high school, mm-hmm. and I think the settlement for it was $120 million to build schools in the villages, and while they were once they got that money, they used that money, and that helped these contractors in Fairbanks, like Toombs and some of them, to be able to survive while they're getting the permits for the pipeline. They were building these schools. Mm-hmm. I remember on Good Morning America, they had a groundbreaking in Little Diomede. And I think there was just two or three high school students, but it was a million dollar school.
Yeah.
But and at the time that the rest of the country was, you know, consolidating schools, Alaska went back to the Little Red
yeah,
Schoolhouse.
That's interesting. Uh-huh. But yeah, I didn't realize that worked out, that they could build the schools while they were waiting for the pipeline.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it gave them some work to do.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, land claims really gave the native people a lot of experience and power that they hadn't had before.
Uh-huh.
And I would think that the newspapers and that method of communication may have helped with all that.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure.
We didn't have cell phones and the internet.
You see, right away, they would, you know, the people in one village would wonder how they do it in another village. Until you can get communicating,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's how we help each other.
Right.
You know,
when I was saying there were no cell phones and no internet, uh-huh. and no telephones in many communities,
and to fly somewhere was expensive.
Right. So if they got a newspaper, that would tell them what was happening in other places.
In other places.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. Well, and, you know, it was smart to send that out to all the villages.
Uh-huh.
That your paper got out to all those villages.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, he tried to cover the things, and but I was so pleased when they did the honoring. I went down, and my son and grandson came to it at Anchorage when the press club honored
yeah.
Tom with that and Howard.
Nice. I was just going to ask you something else about the Tundra Times banquets. I've seen photographs, and I know they happened, and they would have different speakers, but can you describe more about those?
Well, they made, you know, that they were large, and they, you know, they charged a good amount for it, and it brought in money.
That's, and they were here in Fairbanks or in Anchorage?
They had them both places. But the ones I remember are here, but I think they did have them also in Anchorage mm-hmm. later on.
And so that was separate from like an AFN annual convention?
Oh yeah. Thunder Times Banquet was just a Thunder Times Banquet.
And did they have speakers?
Yeah, they'd have speakers. Well, Tom, they even did a, Tom even had a, what was it called? A First Amendment Congress, you know, they go to outside. Well, he had one here, and he had, you know, a panels and judges and lawyers and everybody on them, you know, to discuss different issues. You know, they, but always freedom of the press. He was big in freedom of the press. Them being able to. There was one incident which was. It's kind of hard to tell it in a short amount, but Judge Van Humusen tried to stop the presses. He sent a policeman over to the Newsminer. They were printing our paper. And what it was about was this girl had been murdered out near the Boondocks bar, and at first they thought she was on Allison property, but it turned out she was killed not on Allison property but in the borough. So at first nobody heard about it, and then finally it was in the courts, and they didn't want to do anything to sabotage the case. So they, after the initial part of the court case, they closed it off. And then Van Humusen thought he had released, Tom went to get the tape, and you know, up until they closed it off. And he thought somehow that he'd given the tape that had the whole thing on it. So he wanted an advance copy. Well, that's called prior restraint, and that's one thing that Tom did not go for, was prior restraint. It was, so they sent the state troopers to the Newsminer, and so Bob Perry calls Tom, and he says, Tom, he says, the state troopers are here. I said, they're wanting an advance copy. He said, what do you want me to do? And Tom said, just proceed, you know, so they're wanting to stop the presses. Tom said, proceed with all possible haste. And they did, and they two pressmen, which usually didn't do that, they brought the papers out themselves and threw it in the back of my truck. And then I was afraid to go back to the All-Alaska Weekly office on 2nd Avenue. I went up behind the co-op until it kind of cooled down, because I thought if they're sending a policeman there, they're probably sending them to our office. And he later tried to get Van Humusen to come to the press club and talk about it, and he wouldn't. Mm-hmm. But just a lot of incidents. But he was right in there for freedom of the press. He was big on that.
Yeah. Are there any particular stories that you can think of that, you know, you kind of broke the story first before anybody else that was significant?
Oh, he was always breaking the stories. That was the big thing about it. He could, but I don't know. They used to call him over to Problem Corner at the last minute. Larry Carpenter was
on the radio.
On the radio. And at the last minute, and he would always go. And so one time they was wanting to know what has happened lately that, and that was when this thing happened with Jack Tripp and I don't remember all the details, but there was money inside that they were shipping, money inside the frame of pictures and everything. Oh. Anyway, it was a big deal. But Tom would even come out with breaking news there that nobody had ever heard about. And so a lot of his stories were that, one of them was, he reported on this this woman from Venati, and she went over the hill on a snow machine, on a four-wheeler with her boyfriend. And she lay there for, I think it was 5 days or whatever. My. And she's hollering for help, and she's not too far away. It's somewhere near Fairbanks. And we went to the hospital, and she told him a little bit about it. And then he come and got, he went first, and then he come and got me, and he said, have her tell you, so she'll go into more detail. And it was a breaking news story.
And did you know her? That's why she would tell you more, or because you were a woman?
Well, I think as a woman, and also because I had worked with a lot of the village people. And telling it to somebody else, you know, he's trying to get more details, and she was not going into great detail.
Right.
But, and he reported on this Kentucky man that was in the wilderness for I don't know how many days it was, 90 days or whatever. Mm-hmm. There was, but a lot of stories like that, mm-hmm. where he would be able to present it. For the Newsminer one time, that was, you know, they were shipping so much pop and stuff out to the villages. And he wrote a story about Johnny go down to the post office and get a bottle of milk. And another time he wrote a story about something about a Benji dog, the dog that would not bark or something. But he just had a lot of stories, you know, that he did, and he enjoyed all of them.
Sounds like he had a good sense of humor also.
He did. He went around with, I know his mother, Stella Carpenter, here, she's a pioneer, and her son, when he was in kindergarten, Tom went rode around with him on the school bus and told what it was like, you know, starting kindergarten.
Oh, that, what a great idea.
He knew a story when he saw it.
Yeah.
And one time I told him, well, we had in-service day at Austin, and we're all down on the floor giving each, learning CPR. He said, would you get a picture? A lot of times, you know, he wouldn't want a picture of something I suggested. He'd say, no, that's, you know. But he said, would you get a picture? And I said, no. And he said, well, that would have been an interesting picture, you know, of us
all, you know, the teachers
teaching each other CPR on in-service day.
You had mentioned about the Newsminer, for example, and the issues on reservations and things. So I'm wondering if in the land claims period, the relationships between the Native and the non-Native community, I mean, that's a general question. I mean, I know you worked very closely, mm-hmm. Native, Tom did, so how common was that connection versus being opposed?
Well, you know, it's nothing like it is today, but there was conservative ideas and liberal ideas, mm-hmm. and the Newsminer were more on the conservative side. Mike Dalton was very conservative.
Yes.
And
Tom was more the liberal side?
I think so. He was good to both. I mean, we had the Republicans and Democrats come in there with their ads, and, you know, he talked, interviewed both of them. He got their statements, even though sometimes it'd be very expensive for us to call or whatever if they hadn't sent their statement in. He would give politicians 500 words to put in the paper free, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very good about trying to give both sides of something and not take out words like the Newsminer did of his stories, mm-hmm. you know. So he tried to get both sides of it.
And the Native community supported the weekly and appreciated its reporting?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think they've supported, you know, Tom and me and the work we've done.
Yeah,
you know.
Because I know they did support the Tundra Times, obviously, was yeah. their paper and their
yeah.
perspective, but I didn't know how they
yeah,
were
they
taken
did.
To
they did, because he carried so many of their issues and continued with those issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then with me going out there and taking pictures, and also having done social work out there and worked with their boarding home students.
Right.
Doing the social work helped me a lot later on when I was doing the boarding home students,
right.
because I already knew the people.
Right.
But, no, it all kind of, you know, I think you go through life and you do this and you do this and you do this, and suddenly a lot of things come together to help you
right.
to do something else, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just wondering, you know, the atmosphere in the state, you know, because you do read articles that there was opposition to land claims. you know, and the governor, Hickel, for a while was against land claims because of what it would mean for the state taking, they felt, taking land away.
Oh, yeah.
So just trying to get a sense of what it was like in Fairbanks and the relationships.
Well, that was an issue, right? That was that reservation thing. It was there, and that was, Tom writes about that quite a lot in that, about, you know, the different opinions on it. But basically, you know, some people weren't willing to give the natives land and stuff. So it was amazing that they got it, you know, that they got it passed.
And that's kind of what I was thinking, is how common was it that there were these friendships and collaborations between natives and non-natives at that time? Or were the communities pretty separate?
Well, you know, it's pretty separate. You know, the Paratovich lady and all, I mean, they had, and it was, we had, you know, we had politicians that were, you know, like Frank Dagnan and Newsom Kenyon, then Hobson and then.
Eben,
They would come, like, trying to think of one person's name, but he would come here and he would say, they didn't have a high school all the way at Barrow, they just had to 10th grade.
Right.
He would say, we love our children, you know, and the Barrow kids, they would still have their language, you know. So, but they were ones that always wanted to have a dance.
Okay.
I was trying to think of the native leader, not Hobson, but I'm trying to think of who it was that would say that when he come here. Anyway, his name escapes me.
I mean, I can think of various native leaders from that time, but they weren't necessarily politicians.
Well, who do you think of?
Well, there? I don't know, depending on the time, but I mean, Eben Hobson was mayor. But Joe Upiksown was very active.
Yeah, Joe Upiksown, that's who. He said, we love our children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was very active in land claims.
And I've got pictures there of Charlie Edwardson.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure Tom and Charlie knew each other.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, just recently, you know, just, I don't know how many years he's been dead now, two or three, not long, but I would have coffee with him and all down at Starbucks because he was around here.
Yeah. Well, that must have been fun, you and Itok, remembering the old days, maybe?
Yeah. I was, Charlie, the way I knew him was through Community Action. I called the first meeting of the Community Action. During the poverty program, we didn't really know how to hook on to it. Sergeant Shriver had come, and I was working at Hospitality House, and they let me use some of my time to work on Community Action. So I called together a group, and we had to have people from all walks of life, and so we met at the Traverse Inn for a year and a half before we ever got any money.
And we
did a number of things, and I would pick up Edith Dugosiak and Hannah Solomon from Birch Park and Eskimo Village to be the low income people, and then we had Dr. Wood and we had Howard Rock and we had military people and business people, and we worked on, and we had Van Winkle from the jail. And we met every Thursday morning at 7 o'clock.
Oh my.
For a year and a half before we got money. But then when we did get money, we got Head Start, we got Neighborhood Youth Corps. I was honored by for my work with Community Action. They had a tea here for me.
Nice.
I was honored by Democratic clubs from all over Alaska.
Nice. So the Community Action was a program that was to help services in the community for the...
It was under the poverty program, is how it was done. So Charlie Edwardson was very involved in it.
I know of Rural Cap, which was in Anchorage. Is that part of the same thing?
Yeah, that's part of the same thing.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize there was one here.
It's all the sauce. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It was, you know, they... Neighborhood Youth Corps helped a lot after the flood. They put the boarding home students to work copying the records from the borough,
which
because they were
wet.
Flooded, they got wet. And so that was real good. They got an income. They got paid for it.
Cool. So did Tom have a favorite story that he had written that he talked about? That he thought was his...
Not that I know
of. No, okay.
He just liked, he would get us all going. I was putting in the entries for at the last minute. Susan Pascavan still talks about how we all got busy, you know, and he would just type out those cut lines and everything to put them for the entries in the press club, because he won those awards every year. And but he was proud of what he did. He would sometimes, you know, we had a little up over the leprechaun room there. We had one big room and then a little room. He'd go back there in his little room and be typing, and then he'd come out and he'd say, no, so not often, but once in a while with an editorial something, he'd say, listen to this. And so he was very proud of what he did.
And that's what I was wondering.
It was his life.
Yeah, that he, before he died, he realized that he made a contribution and he felt good about it.
I think so. I think that was his whole thing. He just wanted to do more and more, but his body wouldn't allow him.
Right, and he did get a commendation from the state legislature for his contribution, he and Howard for their contribution, something from Tanana Chiefs, I think.
He got something from Tanana Chiefs, you know, from his, and he also got something from the legislature and something from the local Fairbanks.
The assembly?
Yeah, I think. Anyway, I've got some of those papers, and it does say the Tanana, the Thunder Times, as well as the Alaska Weekly.
Yeah. So he did get. He lived long enough to get that recognition.
Yeah. He did.
Yeah.
But on the end, you know, he was very sick and he should have had a health aide. You know, he's telling about how he has his table and all. Well, he would never want to work until he got his table all cleaned off, you know, if he was here or where. And he loved to cook. He was a good cook. My mother taught him to cook instead of me. but on the end, he was ill and he should have had a health aide or somebody there helping him.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize how sick he was some of the time. Yeah. So,
and now, was he living here with you at the end of his life?
Oh, no. He was in his apartment. He's in Southall Manor.
Okay.
And he had a health aide for a little bit, and then he was in the hospital, and then I think he was back, and I think they said that the service was discontinued or something. Anyway, he didn't have help. And it was too bad.
Yeah.
But
it sounds like he was somebody who worked right up to the end.
He did. And then Howard did too.
Yeah.
Howard did too.
Yeah. They're very committed.
Yeah.
People. I mean, everybody in the land claims movement as well is the Howard and Tom with the reporting on it.
Uh-huh.
Very dedicated to their craft.
Well,
so,
I probably worn you out with two
minutes. No, I was thinking I probably worn you out. Unless you have any other notes there.
No, I think
we've covered it.
Yeah, this, you know, it could go on and on, but I'm a little bit tired right now.
Right, no, that's great. I appreciate your time. I think we've got the highlights.
Yeah, good.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.